Hello and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. And this is one of the occasional bonus episodes that we do for Fade Out, where we don't talk about the career of some Hollywood luminary. This just gives me a chance to have some conversations, movie-related conversations that I want to have on a podcast and don't really fit the Fade Out format. So that's why we're doing this as a bonus show. And joining me is Fade Out, previous Fade Out guest, and my pal, Omar Uden. Hi, Omar. Welcome back.
Hey, Rob. Great to be here.
Thank you very much. Okay. I'm going to warn everybody. For all of you who are listening to this, thank you. Because as you can see in the show notes, Omar and I are here to discuss the 1996 TV movie. It aired on HBO, The Late Shift, which chronicles the battle between Jay Leno and David Letterman to take over for Johnny Carson. This was an HBO TV movie. And how we came about this is very funny because this was a TV movie that I saw at the time and I remembered liking it. And, you know, but just, I just forgot about it. You know what I mean? Like life moves on and you just forget about it. And then cut to like the mid 2000s and I have an Apple account and I start buying movies on Apple because I'm like, oh, well, this is, you know, The Godfather. You know, the 12 Angry Men. This is these are movies I'm going to want to watch over and over. I don't want to rent, but I can own it, and it's one click away. It's great. And then one day, The Late Shift sort of just popped up in my feed, and they were selling it for like $4.99 or something. And I was like, you know what? I really like that movie. I haven't seen it in a really long time, so let me just buy that. Well, in the intervening years, I think I've seen The Late Shift over 100 times, and I am not exaggerating. I cannot believe that this thing just become a late night, no pun intended, like going to bed staple of like, I want to end my night with something easy, you know, nothing super challenging, nothing loud, because often my wife is asleep, so nothing with explosions or gunfire, just people talking. And this movie is like 91 minutes. It's about a subject that I find endlessly fascinating, and by the sub, the movie's really good. So anyway, one night, I'm up very late at like 2 in the morning. I couldn't sleep, and I'm watching The Late Shift for like the 105th time. And I just absentmindedly pull my phone out, and I post on Blue Sky, watching Late Shift for the 100th time. Am I the only person that loves this movie? And thinking, no one's gonna relate to this. And bang, Omar! You popped in and said, you love this movie and you watch it obsessively like I do. And I was like, well, this is just perfect. And so once I saw that the 30th anniversary of this movie was approaching in February of 2026, the movie first aired on HBO on February 24th. So by the time you're listening to this, we are just a couple days past the 30th anniversary of the movie. I knew we had to have this discussion. You've been on multiple shows of mine, and it's always a great discussion. And now here is my chance to have this incredibly nerdy conversation about this movie with one of my favorite podcast guests. So thank you for doing this, and thank you all for listening. Again, if you're listening to this, you're obviously interested in the subject matter, but you got to be warned, Omar and I are going to get granular on this movie and this subject. So before we even talk about the movie, Omar, I want to ask you, let's set the scene a little bit. At the time that this was all happening, and by the way, another podcast, you've taken great delight in pointing out that you're younger than me. Where were you as a late night fan? Were you watching Johnny Carson? Were you watching David Letterman? Like, how much were you interested in the subject matter before you even came to the TV movie?
This whole time that you were talking, Rob, the only thing going through my head was how angry I was that you were able to get this movie for $4.99. I have been obsessed with this topic since Johnny Carson announced his retirement in the spring of 1991. Mm-hmm. I was not into late night per se. Growing up, other than as like a little kid and a young adolescent, I was super into Saturday Night Live, as a lot of us were. And you're right, I am substantially younger than you. I'm very proud of that fact. But I, you know, when it started to become like germane to me, like this was a thing, was when like Carson, this revered figure, beloved by my parents and my friends' parents and my uncles and aunts alike, was stepping down. The chatter and the hubbub about who would replace this sainted man, like, just kind of broke through and got to me. And like, I was only in fifth or sixth grade, fourth or fifth grade. Like, I was a weird kid. Like, as soon as the speculation started happening, it was just like, wait, so it sounds like it's going to be a battle royale between the off-putting curly-haired guy that goes on after Carson with the weird show after him and the Doritos guy. And like the most ridiculous stories were written. And I just like lapped it all up to the point where I had teachers in like fifth grade being like, you seem very obsessive about a very abstract topic. Is everything okay? But yeah, so I love the story. I picked sides. I jumped in as soon as the replacements for Carson have, as soon as Jay Leno started the Tonight Show, I started watching it obsessively. I jumped on to Letterman shortly thereafter. When Letterman started the Late Show on CBS, I jumped over to him, watched him obsessively, watched the rise of Conan O'Brien, and like have been reading the trade stories about this specific niche subject since 1991 or 92. So I've been plugged into the story forever. And I would say that I saw the Late Shift when it first aired in 96, and I loved it. I will say that the book that it's based on is like one of the great pieces of entertainment reporting that I've ever read in my life. It's
Bill
a
Carter's
wonderful
book,
book.
yeah.
Bill Carter's book, it's sensational as a like document of history, as a piece that contextualizes things, as a piece of reporting that doesn't actually take sides, that empathizes its subjects. I think it's the Bible, really. I do, of like of entertainment reporting. I read that book every 2 to 3 years. I've read other Bill Carter books, including his book about Jay Leno and Conan O'Brien from 2010.
Oh,
So I've been
God.
plugged. I've been plugged into this story, and I have so many opinions. I've been plugged into this story for 30 plus years.
Right, good to know. Yeah, I look, as you pointed out, I am older than you, and I don't know anyone who might be listening to this who's going to be younger than us generally, but maybe there's a few people. I watched Johnny Carson as a kid. I loved it. I've always loved the kind of old-timey humor. I grew up on Abbott and Costello and things like that, and the Three Stooges, and so Johnny's generation was obviously way before mine, but I loved it all. And it is hard to really convey to people in this modern lack of a monoculture of how huge he was. I mean, easily the biggest star to ever come out of television. And he was on that show for so long, and he was such a public fixture that he was like a public utility.
He
Like
was.
you popped in and out of that show when you felt like it because you knew it was going to be on. Like you just were like, well, what does he have on tonight? Okay, I won't watch it again for 3 months. Then I come back in. Oh, the Mighty Carson Art Players. Great. Oh, we've got this young stand-up and this actor that Johnny loves. It was really like a river that just flowed. And
And correct me if I'm wrong, I feel like, I mean, you can speak to this better than I can because I've only been exploring it in retrospect. But like, I have to imagine, Rob, that there was something in a world between 1962 and 1992 when he was on the air, in a world that like became radically different, right? Even more radically different than like between 1992 and now. Like in a world that like just kind of exploded in technicolor, politically, culturally, technologically, like there had to have been something massively comforting as a viewer to like be put to bed by Johnny Carson every night.
Yeah, that's really, yeah, because it's, and if you watch some of the reruns now, admittedly, it's not that funny because the humor is very corny, and it's a lot, but you have to remember that it really was like very soothing. It was just like, okay, this guy is so effortless. Well, he's not effortless, but it looks effortless at his job. And he is, by this point, again, like the biggest celebrity television has ever produced. So even when he has somebody on who was a legendary actor, he has Jimmy Stewart on or Bob Hope or Clint Eastwood, he's of that level. Like he's the TV equivalent of these people, and they knew him, and they would talk about, oh, Johnny, you and I had drinks the other night. And it just, it was this entree into show business in a way that was incredibly comforting. And so then you flash forward to the 80s and 1981, and then all of a sudden he's got Letterman on behind him. And I watched Letterman. I stayed up during school week, you know, the years when I was in school, I obviously couldn't stay up that late. And it was just, you know, right at the beginning of VCRs, so you could tape things. But in the summer, I stayed up till 1:30 to watch Letterman, because Letterman at 12:30 was like nothing you'd ever seen.
I don't think there's been anything as revolutionary as what David Letterman did with that medium. Like David Letterman, he took this, you know, incredible art form, the late night talk show, and like completely deconstructed it in this wholly original way.
Yeah.
You know, like, and the thing is, I understand the reverence for Johnny Carson, and to an extent I share it in retrospect. And like, I actually think when I go back and look at some of the clips, I'm not going to say it's perfectly timeless, but I think a lot of the stuff in terms of like his attitude holds up, and like his one-liners and his like improvisational wit and his charm. But I feel like even then, understanding the magnitude and power that Johnny Carson held over like the public, I think that you will find like 100 Johnny Carsons before you find another David Letterman.
Yeah. I mean, there was stuff that would go on in Letterman that I thought was so mind-blowing in terms of just, as you're saying, he's deconstructed. Like Johnny Carson's Tonight Show is the ultimate talk show. It is the uber example of the talk show. And then you've got this guy after him breaking it all down brick by brick in a very comforting, very funny way, not in a nasty, although Letterman could be nasty at times, but the show's tone wasn't mean-spirited. It was more like goofy. And yet it was like, oh, wow, this Letterman show is the exact opposite of the thing it's following. And so for that 10 years where it was Carson and Letterman, I'm like, I wish there was a streaming channel that just ran that block of programming every night the way it ran originally.
Sure.
Like, I wish they just said, okay, we're going to start first night on with Letterman. Bill Murray was the guest. Yep. We're running the Carson one, pairing it up with the Letterman, and that's the streaming channel. And
in
I would
fairness,
watch the
I will
living
say,
hell out of that.
YouTube gets you at least a decent way there in terms of getting highlights in a way that people like you and I were starved for in like the 1990s.
There was the one example I will give, and again, we got to get to the TV movie, but the one example I will give, I remember with Letterman, right, was when he used to do viewer mail, right? People would supposedly write in and they would read letters and whatever. And it was all very goofy and stuff. And I would think most of it was real because they would sometimes find the people. Anyway, they did one where a woman said, "Hey, Dave, in a previous episode, you did a cooking segment and I noticed that you cracked an egg with one hand." Right. You didn't crack it and pull it apart with your second hand. He just did the crack and then he maneuvered it open. And the woman was like, "Where did you learn to do that? Because it's really hard to do." And Dave was like, "Well, let me show you." And all of a sudden it cuts to a behind the scenes documentary about how Dave cracked an egg, hosted by Mark Hamill. And they got Mark Hamill, and he's narrating it like it's one of those behind the scenes of the Star Wars movies documentaries. And they were like, we put Dave's hand in front of a green screen, and you've got this hand flicking the egg. And he goes, then Industrial Light and Magic placed tiny electric charges around the egg, and they were And I'm like, they went to all this effort.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I remembered watching it, and I was by myself because it was like, you know, 1 a.m. on a Friday night. And I almost was like, I wanted to look around because I wanted to like converse with someone to say, are you seeing what I'm seeing? This is insane. They went on like a 10-minute thing about this. And I'm like, I can't believe the amount of effort they put into this. This is not. And I saw it one time 40 years ago and I still remember it. And one other thing I'll mention about David Letterman that he deserves credit for, it because I read this in a book about Saturday Night Live. When Saturday Night Live in the mid-80s was at its lowest point, after Eddie Murphy had left, and it was before Lorne Michaels came back, and the ratings were really, really low. And Brandon Tartikoff, head of NBC at the time, was really considering just canceling SNL entirely. And his original idea was, well, Letterman is the hot thing. So he went to Letterman and said, what I'd like to do is cancel Saturday Night Live and you will go on Saturday nights with your own show, except it'll be like a 2-hour version with more guests, more variety. It'll be a big Saturday night version of the Late Night with David Letterman show. And apparently Letterman considered it for a little bit. And then he said, that's too much of a grind to put my staff through to produce that show every week, plus the regular show. And trying to replace Saturday Night Live is asking for trouble. So I'm going to pass. Had he not done that, they would have canceled SNL. That would have been it.
I mean, how about those showbiz instincts, though, right? He's right.
Exactly. I'm like, man, he knew, no, this is not the right thing to do. And I always thought, man, that guy deserves credit for having the presence of mind to know that.
And we'll get to the movie in a second, but I think that goes to the fact that, like, at heart, Letterman is like a broadcaster. He is the epitome of a broadcaster. He has the heart and the soul of a broadcaster. He has the instincts of a broadcaster. And I think that's why he's held in such, you know, high esteem by so many people who understand the medium and care about television.
Yeah, it really is just amazing stuff. So I was all in. So, and when all this happened about Johnny leaving, and I watched the whole last year of Johnny when he had the murderer's row of guests. It was like one night, because it was every big celebrity saying goodbye. Everybody was getting one last bite at the apple. And like one night, the guest list was David Letterman, Clint Eastwood, and Bob Hope. Like, when are you going to see those three people sitting next to one another, right? Just absolutely amazing stuff. So I watched all of that. I remember where I was the night I watched Johnny Carson go off the air. It was a huge thing. So then this whole explosion happens where it might be Leno, it might be Letterman, blah, blah, blah. And then you get this TV movie. And I want to know, why do you think you and I watch this so – what is it? What is it about – you know, it's not like it's a perfect movie. It's a little cheap looking and it's a little cheesy in places, but it's like, what is it? Why do we watch this?
I think here's what it is. I don't mean this to sound insulting to you and me. I think this is the smart person's equivalent of a guilty pleasure.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
Like there is a certain, I don't want to say hackneyed quality because it's a totally fine movie, but like you can definitely see in 1996 that like the gulf between TV movie and movie was like far bigger than it was going to be like 20 or 30 years later.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
But that said, it is still a testament to the people running HBO and sort of like the cachet that they had and their technical abilities, that they were able to get buy-in from the best-selling author of the book who ended up writing the screenplay, as well as get like first-rate Hollywood actors, including like, you know, people who ended up getting Emmy nominations for their performances, particularly Kathy Bates and Treat Williams, to appear in this. I think the reason you and I like it is that it scratches a particular itch. And it sits in that middle ground between like kind of like highbrow and like trashy. It is the equivalent of like turning off your brain for like the Volvo driving college set. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I have to think that part of it is it's a window into a time when there was so little news. That this dominated the news cycle. This
of
like
course.
Which millionaire is going to get to host the Tonight Show?
As opposed to
the absolute shit show that the world has been basically for this entire century.
One of my favorite political columnists refers to the 1990s as like the holiday from history. Because even discounting the fact that the 21st century has been gestures broadly, what it has been, you know, like this, the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s had some defining like cultural quality that like had the connotation of like, you know, either hardship or like vivid technical, even if it wasn't a hardship or like cultural like explosion, there was something like vivid and like you know, multifaceted about it. Whereas like the 90s was like steady prosperity, and that's all.
Yeah,
and that's fine. It culminates in what I always say of like, you know, we again, not to get too political about it, but just like it culminates in a presidential election that actually ends up being more consequential than we would have thought. But a presidential election in 2000, where the biggest thing the candidates were fighting over was what to do with the extra government surplus money.
Oh God. It was a simpler time. Yes, I think that is part of it, is that the biggest stakes in this movie is, like I just said, which multimillionaire is going to get to replace Johnny Carson. That's it. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to die. Nobody's going to get shot. No one's going to, you know, and that's comforting in a very strange way. So, okay. So anyone who has not seen this movie, let me just set the stage a little bit. It's directed by Betty Thomas, the former actor from Hill Street Blues, who went into a directing career. She directed the Howard Stern movie, Private Parts. So it's directed by her. It stars, you mentioned her, Omar, Kathy Bates as Helen Kushnick, which is Jay Leno's fire-breathing manager. John Michael Higgins from all of the Christopher Guest movies as David Letterman. Wonderful character actor Daniel Roebuck as Jay Leno.
He's great. Yep.
He is wonderful. I've always liked him, and he's great in this. Bob Balaban, again, from the Christopher Guest movies as NBC president Warren Littlefield. You've got Peter, a lot of these are character actors. Peter Jurassic, again, these are names that you don't know, but when I show you the face, you go, oh, that guy. He's the head of CBS at the time, Howard Stringer. You've got a guy named Rennie Santoni as John Agolia, who is one of the kind of business functionaries of NBC.
Real great villain, by the way.
He's great in this. John Capolos, who you probably know as the janitor from The Breakfast Club, as Robert Morton, Letterman's producer. I want to ask you who your kind of favorite person is in this movie. I'm going to get to mine right now. The secret star of this movie, Stephen Gilborn as late night consigliere Peter LaSalle. This guy,
he was very good.
Every scene that this guy is in, I'm like, I want this guy in my life. I want Peter LaSalle in my life.
Like Peter LaSalle has been like a horse whisperer to the stars. He's been like phenomenal. He's been like Forrest Gump or Zelig, always like showing up.
Yep.
Conciliary and like serious advisor for Johnny Carson, for Letterman. He got Craig Ferguson, his late night show. He's wonderful. And the actor who played him was sensational.
Oh, he's this wonderfully avuncular, warm-hearted guy who is also a kind of show business shark. Like, he knows what deals to cut, what deals not to take, and we'll talk about all that. But like, every time Peter LaSalle in this movie shows up, I'm just like, oh yeah, I want more with Peter LaSalle.
And also, to your point of a couple minutes ago about how the fact that like none of this should be taken that seriously, Peter LaSalle also like a Holocaust survivor, and
that's,
you know,
right, that has to inform his life of like, look what he's been through, and now he's dealing with this. Like, this is nothing compared to
allows
what he's
you to keep your perspective.
Yeah, exactly. John Getz, who probably most you know from Blood Simple or The Fly, is Brandon Tartikoff. The great Lawrence Pressman, TV actor stable Lawrence Pressman, is the NBC chair Bob Wright. Sandra Bernhard has a cameo as herself as a guest on Letterman. Treat Williams, the great Treat Williams, is super agent Michael Ovitz. And then there's and in a smaller role, Rich Little, the impressionist and comedian,
as
Rich
the king
Little
himself,
as Johnny Carson in basically one or two scenes. And then there's a lot of other actors in this thing. But the stage is set is that it opens with Carson, with Helen Kushnick wants Jay Leno to get signed to be the new host of The Tonight Show. That's what she wants. And she is an absolute barn burner about getting it. Like, she is not shy about calling these NBC executives assholes. And there's going to be some language in this episode because you can't help it, because she is a fire-breathing dragon in this movie and apparently in real life. And she actually sued the makers of this movie because she didn't like how she was represented, because apparently it's accurate. Yeah. But she wants Leno signed, and NBC is wavering because they're like, well, we have Letterman here. Plus, Johnny's not going anywhere. He's still Johnny Carson. And she is like, he's a fossil. Let's get rid of him. Let's kick him out now. And they're like, Helen, we are not kicking out Johnny. What the hell are you talking about? We're not kicking out Johnny Carson. So then other networks start circling and saying, well, wait a minute. They can't, NBC can't give The Tonight Show to both people. So let's go after Leno ourselves. And so that starts. And then all of a sudden, Johnny Carson announces, in fact, he is retiring. And that starts this feeding frenzy. Meanwhile, NBC decides to give Leno The Tonight Show secretly. They don't tell anyone. They have this backdoor contract with Jay Leno. Letterman doesn't know it. Then Letterman sits down with the NBC executives and says, okay, well, I want The Tonight Show. And they're like, sorry, we can't give it to you. And they're like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, we already have a deal with Jay Leno. And that starts Letterman saying, well, now I got to be freed. I got to leave at 12:30 to find another gig somewhere else. And then this whole rigmarole with that about his contract, because this contract that Letterman had with NBC was apparently very, very strict. And then you've got all this stuff of like Peter Sally trying to get Letterman out of this contract by hiring an agent, super agent, Michael Ovitz, as played by Treat Williams. And it's all the machinations of that. And I have to think part of the appeal of this, right, is that we so rarely see TV movies or movies about famous people who are still alive, right? All these people were alive and vital. All this went down in 1991, 92, 93, and this is 96. So is that, I think, is part of the appeal, is that it is a little tabloidy and trashy, and that we're seeing people that we can see on television right now, as opposed to telling a story about people from 40 years ago.
Well, it's tabloidy and trashy and also largely unrefuted. Other than Helen Kushnick kind of going ballistic at the way she was portrayed. But I have to imagine that was more in tone over substance.
Right.
Like, what was key about both the movie and the book was that none of the key players was disputing the essential, like, facts behind the reporting. This was not like highly sensationalized. This was like extremely well sourced and extremely accurate. And just to piggyback on what you're saying, you know, a couple of the details that I think are really important in terms of the chronology you're laying out are that you're right that Carson did announce that he was leaving. But one of an impetus behind Carson announcing he was leaving was Helen Kushnick wanting to like up the ante by planting the story with the New York Post that NBC was actively considering dumping Carson and bringing on Jay Leno.
Yep.
This was done without Jay Leno's knowledge. And so, you know, you start to understand that like these vultures are like, just like circling the drain, ready to make any kind of move. And the other thing I would say to refine what you're pointing out is, you know, you're right. They did not tell Letterman. They made a deal with Leno for CNN in secret. And when they finally told Letterman, he was shook up. But like his immediate move wasn't, I need to go to another network. His immediate move, you know, and this was portrayed in the movie as well as the book, is that, oh my God, my career is over. This is depressing. I am a 44-year-old man, still way younger than you, Rob, a 44-year-old man, and I'm consigned to follow Jay Leno for the rest of my life. So it wasn't until, and the movie portrays this brilliantly, it wasn't until, you know, Peter LaSalle was just like, Dave, are you just going to sit there and take this? Are you just going to accept second-class treatment? Don't you want to get an agent? Don't you want to explore what else might be out there to, like, kind of snap him out of his haze and kind of contemplate that there might be other possibilities? And this is what leads to this meeting with this super agent, Michael Ovitz, who Letterman is so giddy after meeting him that he refers to him as the Godfather. I just met with the Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about performances you really, you know, you really enjoyed. And, you know, I take no issue with what you're listing, but I think, you know, Kathy Bates' portrayal of Helen Kushnick is sensational, but I think Treat Williams just knocks it out of the park.
Oh, he's so good.
I mean, my God, Rob, every time he's in the room, he has the super agent effect on me as a viewer, which is just like, oh, I'm in good hands.
Yes.
I'm going to be taken care of.
You would totally go with anything he told you, because the way of Treat Williams, he has this kind of, he
Yeah.
puts, he, I mean, I've seen Treat Williams in a million movies, right? Prince of the City and, you know, like The Phantom and all these things, wonderful actor guy, you know, our rest in peace. But like, he has this kind of like breathy kind of tone where he, and he's sort of very calm and he's like, you know, Dave, you've set an inordinately high standard and it has been so upsetting to watch you be unrewarded. It's
Dave, I've
just
looked at your
bad.
contract and this has clauses that would make a prisoner blush, and I am frankly angry at the way you've been treated. And like anyone else, Rob, you would be like, this is a huckster. This is embarrassing. But when Treat Williams says it as Michael Ovitz, you are just like, you know, you're right. I am being mistreated.
If there is the one point where he goes through his whole spiel to Letterman and Peter LaSalle, and then he's like, water? Like he
Oh,
breaks the
God.
thing, and you see Letterman just kind of look at LaSalle like, holy shit, you know, because they're just not, he's like, you will get, he's like, you will be offered a late night show from every network and every syndicator. And it's like, he makes it sound like you are going to just, he's like, and if you give us the honor of representing you. It's just like, how would I not sign with this man? How could you not? It's so good. He is amazing. It's a wonderful
It's
comedic
a
performance.
sublime performance. Like, you cannot say, you're like hypnotic. You cannot take your eyes off of him. He's so good. I mean, like, I would say the same thing. I mean, you know, Kathy Bates got an Emmy nomination as well, and like, deservedly so. You cannot take your eyes off of her either, but for a different reason.
All right, now so like let's talk about that a little bit, because there is a scene where one of my favorite scenes in this movie, and again we're gonna bop around because there's just so much to get to, and I don't want to go in order because it's whatever. But there's an infamous moment, which again, as you pointed out, Omar, like this book was sort. By the way, the screenplay, as you mentioned, co-written by Bill Carter, who wrote the book, but also but the other writer was George Armitage, who directed one of my top 20 favorite movies of all time, Gross Point Blank, which is just an
Wait, are you
amazing.
serious?
Yes.
Oh,
This
that's
is,
amazing.
yeah. It's like, what a crazy detail. That's another movie that I've seen 100 times, Gross Point Blank.
It's a wonderful film.
So anyway, as you said, this is ruthlessly sourced. So none of this is in dispute that any of this happened. So apparently one time Jay Leno gets to the Tonight Show, he takes over and they're going to do a live post-election, Republican convention
Oh, God, this story is
episode.
wild.
This is 1996, right?
92.
And 92, oh, excuse me, 92, yes, of course, because Ronald Reagan's on stage making fun of Bill Clinton. Haha, F you, Ronnie. So they do this thing where they're like, okay, well, we're going to have Tom Brokaw come on after the convention. He'll be on with Jay, and they'll be able to do current jokes about something that just happened. So it's going to be a live episode,
It's
but it's
synergy. It's a really good idea.
it is a really good idea, right? To seamlessly blend the news coverage into entertainment. It makes actually a lot of sense. But the news coverage starts to run long. And Kathy Bates, as Helen Kushnick, is watching this on the monitor. And she is like, we're going to run late. This is, the news isn't going to start yet, which means it's going to push Jay back. And she's getting angrier and angrier. And she calls the head of NBC News. And she basically says,
Get this gold gas bag off the air.
get this gas bag Ronald Reagan off the air.
Get this, the 40th president of the United States, an incredibly popular two-term president, off the air because Helen Kushnick says so.
And I love that he is like, you know, he, and then she tries to threaten the head of NBC News with this, and he, Michael Gardner is the man, Gardner is the guy's name, played by actor Michael Fairman, who again, another face that you've seen. If you saw his face on IMDb, you'd be like, oh, that guy. And he is like, I don't give a shit whether Tom Brokaw's on the Tonight Show. I produce the news. I don't care. He's basically like, F off, talk to Bob Wright. So Helen Kushnick decides, well, now that Letterman's going, now that, excuse me, Leno's going to run late, F him, we're not giving them a show. And she walks into the studio and sends everyone home, sends the entire
Insane,
audience
insane.
home.
Rob, as they noted in the movie, this was a live show where the advertising had already been sold. I cannot emphasize, and nor can you, like the sheer lunacy in like cutting a show like that.
And so she does it. She sends everybody home. And there's even a point where Jay is like, can you do this? And she is like, basically, F you do the jokes. I run the show, which is, it suggests there's a whole thing of like, you know, Jay, why would you let this woman? I know that she got you this gig, but like, why is you let her talk to you like this? You're the, you're, you're, You're her boss. It's like, it's not, you know, she's not your boss. You're her boss. So she ends the, she just ends the show and she doesn't tell anybody. So then you cut to Warren Littlefield showing up. He's president, the head of NBC, shows up and he's like, okay, well, we're running a little late, but we'll probably get on the air in like 15 minutes. And he walks into the studio and it's empty. And he's like, what happened? And these other functionaries are like, there's no show. Helen killed it. And he's like, she killed a scheduled show. And he even says something like, you just point, he says, I already sold this thing to advertisers. Now, I don't get too much into what I do in my daily, for my daily job. I work in television advertising. This is a monster huge deal. For the people that do this, this is huge. And then they cut to this thing where you've got Warren Littlefield and there's John Ogolia talking to Bob Wright, the head of the network, and there's this wonderful line where he's like, we had 15 minutes to get that rerun on, or we would have gone dark. And there's some, the way Lawrence Pressman delivers that line of like, we are NBC, and we were within 15 minutes of literally running blank screen because we could not have, we might not have been able to get a rerun on in time. That in the annals of television cannot happen.
That's
And
insane.
it is
That's insane that I was
nuts.
even close to happening.
And that
On a
is,
broadcast network, not even on a cable channel, on a
no.
broadcast network.
Yeah. It is, that is, it, again, I work in TV, and if that ever happened, the holy shit, would the amount of people get fired and screamed at about this? And so they don't mince words about this. So anyway, they sit her down and they say, they rewrite her contract and they say, Helen, you can't be doing this anymore. You cannot. And there's this whole thing about where she's taking it out on guests that won't cancel, doing appearances on Arsenio. Like she's just burning every bridge left and right. And they sit her down and they say, you can't do this anymore or you're going to be fired. And she has this speech where she's like, this is only happening because I'm a woman. Would you do this if I was a man? Now, what do you think about that scene? Do you think that that has any, look, we're not going to pretend that sexism isn't run rampant in all walks of American life, in all walks of life, period, especially the entertainment industry. But did that have any salience to you at all? Or is it that, no, it's that you're out of your mind, Helen. You can't do some of these things.
Well, I mean, like, listen, I think it's a really good question, and I think that, like, I'm reminded of this every time, I watch this and read about it, and having done a deep dive on Helen Kushnick, it's that all these things can be true at once, right? It's that if you are growing up, in the, in the professional ecosystem of the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, as a woman who is charged with being an entertainment representative and an agent, it's probably 10,000 times harder, oftentimes for very stupid, arbitrary reasons, oftentimes because of like ill-fated assumptions by like very dumb men who are like gatekeeping things. And I one point I always make, not to get on a soapbox, is that like one of the reasons that like it's probably good to tear down the patriarchy is that like one of the many unpleasant side effects of like sort of patriarchal dominance is that it leads to the kind of overcorrection you see from people like Helen Kushnick, who justifiably growing up in that environment and coming to terms and making their bones in that environment, had to, by necessity, develop a thick skin, assume the worst in people, preemptively like fight battles, because that was the only way to scratch and claw and get ahead. But if that's the only thing that you know, and that is the approach that's sort of encalcified in your brain, then like you cease to be of value, in a very real, multifaceted way once you elbow your way, like sort of into the club, right? So like this stuff has scar tissue. So like, yes, I mean, part of it is just like, Helen Kushnick doesn't sound like a super pleasant person to be around.
No.
She also, by the way, and the movie mentioned this, and the book goes into this too. She also had tremendous tragedy in her own life.
Yes.
She gave birth to twins one of whom got infected with AIDS in the early 80s, back when that was essentially a death sentence. The infant did end up dying.
Yeah.
Her husband, also an entertainment lawyer, fell ill with colon cancer within a couple years after that, and he died. She herself battled breast cancer multiple times. In fact, she sadly passed away the same year that the Late Shift movie came out.
Yeah, she died very young. She died only a couple years older than me, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and like, you know, she actually has a surviving daughter, the one who was born along with a twin who had AIDS, and it's just like that daughter has given multiple interviews where she's just like, my mom had to be tough. My mom was tough because she had to be tough. And so, like, you know, my long answer to your question is that, like, you sort of get scar tissue growing up in that environment and making your bones in that environment, but like, it's not good. It's not good because, like, you overcorrect. You assume everyone is an enemy, and, like, you know, you treat it like everything, like it's an invasive foreign body, the organ that's attacking your body. And so, like, and then sometimes in show business, Rob, I'm sure you could, all people can attest, that's the right thing to do. And, you know, it was that kind of single-minded approach that secured Jay Leno The Tonight Show, a result that would have been unlikely like 10 or 15 years before it happened. But I think also it's a kind of live by the sword, die by the sword thing. And one of the reasons that, you know, sort of the male-dominated spaces in these professions kind of needed to be torn down was that, like, it oppresses everyone, and it oppresses women, not just in the obvious ways, in the subtle ways, in the way they interact, in the way men react to that overreaction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And they do. And like people are complex, right? Because the movie opens with Helen Kushnick doing raising money for a fundraiser for pediatric AIDS, right? Which you talk about, her one child was given a blood transfusion back when they didn't know,
it's like a terrible tragedy. Seriously.
Yeah. And she dealt with horrendous loss in her life. So, and yet, what is she doing to raise money for the pediatric aid? She's insulting the person on the phone because she's like, come on, you cheap bastard. Now, obviously, you can hear the voice of the guy on the other line. And obviously, they have a very warm but adversarial relationship because she's like, come on, you cheap. And then he finally says, give me two tables. And that's going to be $20,000. So obviously, she's talking to some high roller. So it opens with her doing that. But yet you also see her berate underlings for no good reason. And you're like, well, that's not good. That doesn't make you a better, like, yes, I get that you have to be super tough to excel in this boys club, but you're also screaming at underlings, which does not suggest you have really great character.
And needlessly picking booking wars,
yes,
not just with the ostensible competition, like not just with Arsenio, which is technically your competition and which led to a falling out of the relationship between Arsenio and Jay for a while, not just with Dennis Miller, who had his own late night talk show, which led to a bad falling out between Dennis Miller and Jay that it took a few years to repair, but also with like Jay's own network, with like Letterman when he was following Jay on NBC, with, you know, like attacking Johnny Carson when Jay was the guest host of The Tonight Show, battling their own show for bookings. It's like insane. It's genuinely addled behavior that like serves no one and wins you nothing but enemies.
Yeah. And yet they do take the time to hit on the idea, the fact that it was the work of Helen Kushnick that got the entertainment industry to even look at Jay Leno. Because there's a famous story that Jay Leno has told where apparently when he was younger, before he got on Letterman and became a kind of a comedic superstar, a talent agent told Jay Leno that his face would scare children.
Yeah.
Which is like, oh my God. Like imagine hearing that from somebody. And he even talks about, he's like, you 10 years ago who wasn't blonde and from the Midwest. And he's like, and she was like, I had to move the game. So I moved the game. The game's over here now, assholes. And she's like, and now look at you. You're the host of the time. And she's right. She's entirely right about that. That she bent the will of show business over towards Jay Leno in a way that would never have been done. But then flip it back once again. The original sin of Jay Leno's Tonight Show, which you know where I'm going with this. His first show, you get this moment where Bob Wright calls and says to Helen, how is Jay going to thank Johnny? And she's like, we're not going to thank Johnny. And Bob Wright is like, what are you talking about? That's simple. And she's like, that's kiss up. We don't do kiss up stuff.
Yeah.
And Bob Wright is like, it's simple politeness. You can't take over for Johnny Carson and not acknowledge that what came before. And she basically tells Bob Wright to go F himself.
Yeah.
And Jay doesn't do it. And for years, that hung over Leno. People were like, how could you not thank the guy?
Yeah.
And Jay's pathetic excuse was, well, Helen told me not to do it. And it was like, well, but you don't work for Helen. She works for
Well,
you.
and you know, like one line that Kathy Bates has in the movie is Helen, which was very apropos, was like, you just want to be served the steak. You don't want to see the cows getting
Yes.
slaughtered, which
Yes.
is, you know, a lot of people have a lot of opinions on Jay Leno, and I'm actually eager to get into it with you about it. But like one thing I will say, a criticism of his that I think is per of him that I think is perfectly justified is this idea that like he wants to be like the see no evil, hear no evil person, but he's perfectly comfortable with like, you know, someone like Helen Kushnick in that chair, like doing all the dirty work.
Yeah, entirely. And so, okay, let's talk about Daniel Roebuck as Jay Leno. I love
Sure.
Daniel Roebuck. If
He's
he does
wonderful.
cons like these, like, you know, the horror and TV conventions that my wife and I go to. He's
Yeah.
never been to one that I could down here, but if he's ever at one of these, I'm gonna buy the friggin' Late Shift on DVD and get him to sign it
Oh,
because I
you
just love
should. You
this thing so much.
absolutely should.
So, what do you make of Daniel Roebuck as Jay Leno? Like, what do you think of the what do you think what you know of Jay as a person versus what you think the view of him here is?
Yeah, I here's what I would say. I think the same thing I would be able to say of the portrayal of Leno is the same thing I would say about the portrayal of Letterman. I think maybe it's sub and again, we have spent a couple minutes extolling the virtues of the acting performances in this movie, and both of these guys are good. I would say that because Leno and Letterman are such both exceptionally well known. I mean, you cannot go through the treasure trove of the last 35 years of broadcast network television and come up with many, if any, people who are as famous, if not more famous, than those two. And they also have very like asymmetrical, unique, specific tics in their persona that I think the actors portraying them in the movie maybe played up to the level where it was getting to the limit of what I was comfortable with and could enjoy before it spilled out into open caricature. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's right at the edge a little bit. And,
Yeah.
you know, I mean, imagine trying to, for John Michael Higgins, playing someone as distinctive as David Letterman, like just
Yeah.
as unique. Nobody looks or sounds like Dave. So trying to capture that probably had to be incredibly difficult. And look, this is one of those situations where everyone is at fault in some way and everyone is right in some way. Because look, I don't think most people would argue that on the taste meter, David Letterman was just superior to Jay Leno
I
as
think I you know what? Here's the thing. I don't mean to jump down your throat on your own show, but I think the ratings show that I think most people would argue with that.
well, see, that's the right. I think in 1992, right? And it seemed I like, well, Letterman's clearly going to be he's clearly the heir apparent. Right? They clearly got along with one another, right? Letterman would appear on with Carson and they would make,
Yeah.
and, but yes, you're right. But you look at it from NBC's point of view and it's like, yeah, but okay, we're NBC. Jay Leno is way easier to deal with. He'll go along with everything we ask him to do. And Letterman is just feisty and difficult. And that's what fed into his genius. But it also
Yeah.
made him really difficult. And I could see if you're NBC, you're kind of like, do we want to deal with this guy and hand him the
Yeah.
keys to the tonight? Like,
Like,
is
listen,
for.
listen. Like, there is a mercurial, there's certainly a mercurial quality to David Letterman and this idea of like, show business is ridiculous and I am above it and I am going to make fun of it and deconstruct the medium and it's silly and people involved in entertainment are silly and like, you are right that those same qualities made him a singularly brilliant broadcaster. But I think, and again, when I was a kid, when all this was happening, I was very Team Dave for this very reason that I did see him as sort of sui generis. And like he did tickle my funny bone in a very unique, specific way. But it's also just like, hey, this is like a long-term proposition. And there are people that watch television and late night television that maybe do not live in, just Manhattan and San Francisco and LA, that, maybe they have a say too. And if Jay Leno is generating higher profits and he is willing to do things like go to Timbuktu or like Branson, Missouri and shake the hands with
Talk to affiliates and do
every local
commercials. Yep,
affiliate,
yep, yep.
whereas like David Letterman finds that kind of behavior like undignified and embarrassing.
Yep.
Like in retrospect, I'm just like, oh yeah, that doesn't actually seem like that big a deal. Like it doesn't actually seem like as close a call as it might have seemed at the time. And at the time, as like a sixth grader, I was like, you gotta go with Letterman. Like there's no one like him. And now, with the benefit of hindsight, and by the way, like a good, 20-year period where Jay Leno was just superior, generated higher profits, got more ratings, and by all accounts was easier to deal with. Yeah, no, like I think it was kind of an open and shut case. Like in retrospect, I don't like it. I don't like the fact that like
Right.
it was an easy case to make, but like it kind of is what it is. And I think that both of them are very specific, unique personalities. The movie, I think, where is the book and the source material and the reporting, especially by Bill Carter, does a really good job of being like fairly even-handed. I wonder what you think about the portrayal of the network suits at NBC and CBS in terms of how they approach Letterman and Leno. Did you think that the NBC, like the Littlefield portrayal by Bob Balaban and the Igaglia portrayal and the Bob Wright portrayal, made them out to be kind of like stiff, like penny pinchers, where the CBS people were the visionaries? Like, how did you come down on that?
I think that the movie is pretty nice towards Bob Wright. I think it seems to suggest that Bob Wright was a little, I mean, and maybe because he was higher up in the food chain that he could take a more sensitive handling. But he was,
Well, I don't think
they,
Bob Wright was as convinced. I think Bob Wright was genuinely on the fence. I think
right.
Bob Wright delegated from what the book and the movie indicated. Bob Wright delegated the initial decision to Littlefield and Agoglia, but like as time went on, he started to have regrets and like he tried to reach out to Letterman and forge a relationship with him. So I think the movie was fairly even-handed in like treating Bob Wright as someone who was genuinely open-minded to any possibility.
Yeah, it suggests that Bob Wright, again, and this is the movie's view of him. I don't necessarily know if it's accurate or whatever, but the movie's view of him is that he is willing to consider other things other than dollars and cents in making this decision. Meanwhile, Littlefield and especially John Agoglia are just dollars and cents. They are just, there is creativity be damned. It's all pennies that we're counting. And Bob Wright, there's a scene where they talk about pushing Johnny out because his viewership is starting to slip a little and his viewership is older. And Bob Wright has a line where he's like, "Are you really telling me you want to get rid of Johnny Carson? Like this, like what the hell are you talking about? We have Johnny, And as you say, he goes and he talks to Letterman and tries to talk Letterman out of leaving versus Littlefield and Agoglia are just bean counters. Like just, that's all they care about. And but I could also see that if you're looking at Letterman and you say, well, okay, he's brilliant at 12:30, but he can't do that show at 11:30. People at 11:30 don't want to see elevator races. They don't want to see things getting crushed by steam shovels. Like that, that's not what that show. And I could see you saying, can he do the show that we need him to do? But then again, this thing is like a kaleidoscope with so many views because there's a moment where they sit him down and they tell Dave, we've gone with Leno, but we want to keep you. And Agoglia says, we have an expanded idea of late night
A
where we
seamless
want
2-hour block.
a seamless 2-hour block. And that is like, do you have any understanding of the man who has had a television show on your network for 11 years? He wants to be distinctive. The last thing he wants is to be second fiddle to Jay Leno. And you guys don't even know. You don't. How do you not know that? He's been your employee for a decade. And that's because Agoglia probably doesn't even care. It's just whatever I got to say to sign this guy, that's all I care about, you know?
I think, like, honestly, holistically, Rob, I think at the end of the day, when I think about this movie and I think about this book and I think about the endless arguments about Jay versus Dave and later, like, Conan versus Jay and everything, the thing that always, like, is made apparent to me is that, like, none of the players here, none of the major players in any era, whether it was David Letterman, Jay Leno, Bob Wright, John Agolia, Littlefield, like Conan O'Brien, any of these guys, like Jeff, Gaspin and Zucker, later, 15 years later, they just did not understand a simple proposition of, like, NBC has this one show that for whatever reason is revered and it is treated like a national treasure and, as you indicated, a public utility. And, like, there is just one of those jobs at a time, and only one person gets to have that job. And it's a job that everyone wants, but only one person gets to have it at one time. And the fact that they've kind of failed to understand that, like, this is sort of like the trap door under which everything, follows is just like, no, simple proposition. It's one job that everyone wants, and only one person gets to have that job. And you can't split the baby. You can't compromise. You can't, have a seamless 2-hour block. Okay? You can't, as the movie portrays, as the Late Shift portrays, you can't do some half-assed thing where you let Jay Leno have the show for a year and a half and then try to fire him and give David Letterman Jay Leno's old show, that's been damaged goods and without the guarantee of even being able to get it. You can't, give Conan O'Brien this show that follows Jay Leno again. You can't, like, you just, it's just one show. It's just one show. One person gets to host it. And, like, you cannot have it any other way. And the fact that, like, all these incredibly smart people did not understand that, like, one person gets to have this job, we have to make a decision, we have to rip the band-aid and, like, that to let the chips fall where they may. The fact that, like, all these seemingly smart, educated people with net worths that dwarf yours and mine forever don't seem to grasp a very simple concept is, like, both hilarious and troubling.
Yes, very much so. Very much so. We talked about it earlier. There is a moment where Helen Kushnick is talking to this manager named Ken Cregan, Ken Cregan, who's a real
Oh, the
person,
country music guy.
plays himself, and he's a manager for Travis Tritt, and she's like, "We want to have Travis on the show." And Ken says, "Well, he's doing Arsenio. Sorry, he's not available." And she's like, "Screw Arsenio, cancel him, book have him on the Tonight Show." And Ken is like, "Well, I can't really do that. We gave Arsenio our word." And she immediately goes to, like, "Okay, you hick." She calls him a hick. And then a minute later, you find out that another Cragen client who was booked for the Tonight Show gets
Trisha
canceled.
Yearwood.
Trisha Yearwood gets canceled in retaliation. So then Ken Cregan is like, "Well, I'm not putting up with this bullshit," and he just calls the LA Times and gives the story. And you cut to Littlefield and Agolia, and they're like little weasels because they're like, "Ooh, independent verification," and you're like, "Do your jobs, do your th don't let him do your job for you. You guys make, as you just pointed out, like, you guys make tens of millions a year to do
It's
your
just
job."
insane. It is insane that, like, these people vested with so much authority and, like, are compensated at, like, astronomical levels. Like, it's like their manhood shrinks, like, at the thought of, like, just, like, kind of making what was seemingly like a simple decision. It's just like you have this out of control manager and it's just like, well, maybe we just wait in place and let her self-destruct. No, don't do that. What are you talking about? Like, and it's just, and again, this is, and we're picking on Agolia and Littlefield. And, like, I mean, it's a little bit unfair because I just feel like that is American corporate, like, groupthink, where it's just like, you don't rock the boat, whatever, just, but it's just like, it's the same thinking, honestly, Rob. Again, not to, like, fuse too many eras here and, like, blur the lines, but it's the same thought that it's just like, oh, we'll promise you the Tonight Show, Conan O'Brien, in 5 years. Don't worry about it. Sign this contract. And it's just like, man, you people just you do everything to, you know, even you, all you do is try to put out every fire and like get from day to day. You have no long-term thinking and you have no idea or understanding about how talent works. And then I just started thinking, well, you know, maybe that's just the American entertainment corporate mindset. And it's like, no, that's the American corporate mindset. It's just like lurch from crisis to crisis. We won't do anything about Helen Kushnick, even though she's clearly like melting down, like a nuclear power reactor, like melting down. Oh, we have two people. 15 years later, we have two people that want this amazing show. Oh, Conan, we'll give you a contract that says you get the show in 5 years, even though the other guy clearly has no designs on ever leaving. Yeah, this will work out fine. Oh, good. This puts out the problem now. We'll worry about it later. How very American.
Totally. I mean, and again, I know we are picking on these two characters, but this is the movie presents
They're
them.
a stand-in. They're a stand-in for like all sorts of, as David Letterman says, network pinhead weasels.
And the like, there's this moment where Littlefield and Egolia have to fly to New York to talk to Letterman. And, you know, Littlefield is a little more genteel of like, look, we have to kind of lay, you know, kind of give him the bad news gently. And Egolia is like, basically, I don't give a shit about this guy. I've got a contract with his name on it. And he's like, my ass is sore from sitting on a plane all day. And I'm like, really? Really? You flew first class from California to New York, and you're what, pissed off about that? Like, you fuck baby. You know, it's like a little like, what is the matter with you? And that, like, you're going to go in to talk to David Letterman with that attitude, that he's like he's just a
He's an
cog in a
inconvenience. He's
wheel,
a pain in
you
the
know?
ass. He's an inconvenience and a pain in the ass that needs to be dealt. Like, listen, again, I think I've laid my cards on the table that, like, you know, as much as I prefer Letterman and his sensibilities and his talent, I think the decision to go with Leno long term was the correct one. But like, it's also just like, how did you not read? Like, it was such a shock to them. And the, you know, the movie touches on this a little. I think the book and the reporting do a more expansive job. It is stunning to me that they did not realize the depth and sincerity of David Letterman's like desire for the 11:30 time slot. It's just like they did not understand. They're just like, oh, you know, it's fine. Dave will be fine. We'll give him more money. We'll do this. We'll do that. We'll do the make this seamless 2-hour block thing. And it's just like, do you have any concept of like talent relations? Do you know this man at all? I understand like Letterman makes it like super hard to get to know him, but like that's a very basic fact. Right up there with like, you know, you and I like movies. You know what I mean? It's not that hard to discern that David Letterman really wanted the Tonight Show. And like, even if you were like pinhead executives and nothing more than glorified bean counters, the fact that you wouldn't take the time to at least put on the dog and pony show of just like, you know, let's go out of our way to soothe Letterman's bruised like ego, and just kind of manage him. And they're just like, ah, oh, golly, it's just like, oh man, we just got to deal with this guy. It's just like he was there for like 10 or 11 years. Like he had a reasonable expectation that he would be seriously considered. He was the farm team. What did they always say in Bill Carter's book? They were the farm team waiting to be called up. Now, I believe that Jay Leno had every bit as much a right to think that he was the farm team because like he was guest hosting once a week for 5 years on the Tonight Show. That's as much as being a farm team as like the show following him for 10 years. But like Letterman had a reasonable expectation that he would be seriously considered. And the fact that Egolia is like, ah, I should be complaining because my ass was sitting in the on a plane and a car to come to New York to break this news. It's like, grow up, dude.
And look, for people too young to remember, Leno made his bones on Letterman's show. He was a regular on Letterman. And look, again, I know that nobody beyond a certain age will believe me, but it's true. In the
Go back and
80s,
look at the YouTube clips of Jay Leno in the early and mid-1980s on David Letterman show. Whatever people think of Jay Leno now, and again, whatever however I feel about the decision to give him the job and keep him in the job, I think that, you know, my tastes just don't line up with Jay Leno. I think everyone else, Carson, Letterman, Conan, much more phenomenally gifted broadcasters, performers, comedians than Leno. So much more multidimensional. But I'll tell you what, there was a brief moment, Rob. There was like a 10, 15-year period when you were still young and Jay Leno was cool as hell.
He
And
was
there's no
really funny.
better evidence of that than like the appearances he would make on the Letterman show on NBC
He
in
would
the early,
crush.
mid, and late 80s. He was unbelievable. All of my friends who like rag on Leno for being lame, I tell them to watch his appearances on Letterman, and they do not believe what they are seeing.
And you couldn't know that the guy that you were hiring, who was so sharp and so fun, I saw him in concert once when I was a kid. I went with my
Oh,
parents.
I believe it.
I would have
He
been
was a
like
road
12 or
warrior.
13. He was so funny and so hip and so great that you're like, you could not have guessed that. Okay, but once he gets the job, within a couple of years, he's going to do Dancing Itos. And you're like, what the hell happened to this guy? You know, you're just
Letterman has
like,
David Letterman has always said of his generation, like, and by the way, his generation included people like Robin Williams. Okay.
yeah,
Of his
Jerry
generation,
Seinfeld, all
Jerry
the
Seinfeld,
yeah.
like Jay Leno was like the North Star in terms
Yep.
of like funny, just like having a point of view, someone whose like sensibility you wanted to ape. He was the role model. And you know, somewhere along the line, once he got the brass ring was within his grasp, he decided that he wanted to be more like a Bob Hope, pre-date rape Bill Cosby, just like sort of a sensible, like, you know, have a sensibility that was palatable for everyone.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it was just like you have the dancing Itos and you have like the edge taken off. And it's just like, oh, come on, man.
Yep.
That sucks. And it just, it ends up just, you end up having like a legacy of a 22 years of hosting the Tonight Show where it was just like, blah. This is like singularly unmemorable. Again, I good decision to keep him. Good to, you know, bad decision to, you know, even consider firing him when he didn't want to go. Bad decision to try to bring on Conan. Like Jay got ratings from a commercial standpoint. He was stable. It was fine. But like as a comedian, it was just like, why would you leave all that on the table? And you know, I just seeing this movie, you know, just reminds you how asymmetrical and unique and sui generis someone like Letterman was. And from a creative standpoint, what a, you know, what a boneheaded mistake it was for NBC to not give him, you know, the brass ring. But like, you know, it is what it is.
One of the things that they, this isn't in the movie, but it's in the book that they point out is that one of the things, again, that helped them give this, make this decision is that Leno was a workhorse and he wanted nothing else but to be the host of The Tonight Show and tell jokes. And he actually went to the NBC and said, for the 6 to 8 weeks a year that we get vacations, that the staff gets vacations, would you be willing to hire an entire alternate staff to work those 6 to 8 weeks so I can do the show 52 weeks a year?
And
I
NBC was
mean,
like,
that is, yeah, no, thank
no.
you. Yeah, which is nuts, right? Which you're, but again, if you're John Agolia, you're like, this guy's a unicorn. How do we, you know, we keep this guy forever? He wants to just make us money. And when that's what you're there to do when you're these guys, okay. You know, it's totally
Did you know
understandable.
that, like, you must have known this? Did you know that, like, at the height of hosting The Tonight Show, he would still did up to 150 nights of
It's
stand up a year?
insane. It's nuts. I mean, well, okay, side thing, because I don't know when else I'll think to mention this, but it's just sort of, since we're talking about Leno so much, there's something about like the overarching enmity that people have for Jay Leno, even probably people who don't even really remember him, in that a couple of months ago, Jay apparently gave an interview with some newspaper where he said, if you do political jokes, you're cutting half your audience in half, and why would you do that? Now, okay, on there's so many hands to talk about this topic. You have to like have like 17 hands. On the one hand, from someone from his point of view, that makes total sense. If you want to be a broad-based comedian and you want to offend a nobody, that makes complete sense. On the other hand, it's really lame. It's an incredibly lame way to look at comedy that it's like, what, you know, you're like the, what, you're like the human equivalent of like a Bazooka Joe, you know, comic strip where it's like, you just
Well,
go, you know,
100%.
you
Like,
know.
one of the best criticisms I ever read of Leno was by Jimmy Kimmel, who said he made he like we all loved Leno growing up, but he
Yep.
turned comedy into factory work.
Factory work. Yep.
You know, and
Factory
it's just
work.
like it doesn't act. And like, I genuinely don't believe he's like that. Like, I mean, in terms of what's in, you know, what passes for his heart. Like, I remember, you know, in 2020 during the height of the pandemic, like he did like comedic fundraisers, virtual Zoom fundraisers for Joe Biden. You know, because he was so alarmed by like how, you know, like the direction the country was going under the first Donald Trump term. But it's true that he just does not stick his nose in the political arena. Now, like other people don't do that. Like Conan O'Brien is not a big political comedian, but Conan O'Brien does that from a general like sensibility of like, oh, that's not really my milieu. And I traffic in silliness and vaudeville or whatever. Where Leno is like he just talks about it like, oh, you'll alienate half your audience. I mean, come on, he talks about it like it's a stock. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's just this dry, soulless thing. And
right.
He measures success as a comedian by ratings. Which is why he was always just, you know, very quick to tout the fact that he, you know, the Tonight Show was number one under him. And like, that's fine. If you look at comedy as a commercial enterprise, that is a perfectly logical, you know, conclusion to reach.
Right.
I think it is kind of it's kind of upsetting, especially in this day and age, to think of comedy as purely a commercial enterprise. But like, it does not, you know, again, NBC was correct to keep him and hire him. But it's just, it's too bad because when you think about the sensibility of the fellow that you and I saw on the Letterman show and that you saw live, it's just like, but you could have been so much more.
Right.
And you deliberately chose not to be.
Yes. And right. He's letting you know that like his art that he's given his life to, which is being a comedian, is all just, you know, again, turning it into factory work. I think that quote from Kimmel is really good. So anyway, when this story broke, right, I saw it on Blue Sky. And I just wrote kind of, you know, to just like, all right, yeah. And everyone was dumping on him. And I just said, look, okay. I said, can I just point out, though, I said, we all know that, like, Leno doesn't seem to have much of an interior life. He doesn't have children.
Nope.
And his wife of like pretty much the only person in his life is his wife, who a couple of years ago was revealed is suffering from early onset dementia.
Yeah.
So, and the only relative he had was a brother who passed away.
Yeah.
Right. And
parents
I said,
passed away while he was hosting the Tonight Show.
Right. And I just said, look, I said, this is a guy who was put out the pasture. He probably doesn't get interviewed much anymore because really who the hell kind of cares what he has to say. So I just said, I do have some sympathy for a guy. Who is probably sitting in his garage with his $1 million worth of cars, and he's kind of a little sad, and he probably has a kind of unfathomable wealth, but probably a sad, lonely life, and that the one person in his life was his wife, who he is now having to take care of.
Yeah.
I just said, it's a little sad. I said, it's just, I understand why he said it. I don't agree with it, but I understand from that person's perspective why he would say it. Holy
totally
shit.
Reasonable response, Rob. A totally reasonable response.
Well, that doesn't work.
Because Jay Leno is the devil, that was not the response you got.
That does not work on the internet. I had someone literally call me a Nazi and said I should die. I should die because I didn't immediately say Jay Leno was like a serial killer. Now, look, obviously, like, that has more to do with that person who clearly cannot be on the internet because they can't handle it.
This is where it gets like, this is where my protective instinct becomes a little more like, here's the thing. Jay Leno is not for me. Jay Leno in his Tonight Show incarnation and his current incarnation, not for me. But like, Jay Leno is not an evil person.
No.
You know, I think of other comedians. There are plenty of comedians. I'm thinking of someone like Bill Maher, who like has a certain point of view and is like very like vituperative and like mean-spirited, and uses whatever passes for his comedic sensibility right now to like cut people down to size. And like with Jay Leno, it's just kind of like, no, this is not like a malicious person. This is not a person of like bad intent. This was a person who just like saw the brass ring, went for it, and like has little to offer outside of like the jokes that like made like my parents laugh quite a bit in the 1990s. And like, that's fine. Like, I'm not going to nominate him for sainthood. And I don't think that I don't think he's going to be remembered in the pantheon of comedians the way that like Letterman and Carson and Conan are, or Jon Stewart, for example. But like, he just kind of did his thing. And the magical thing is, you can watch Jay Leno, you cannot watch Jay Leno, and it's perfectly fine. What I choose to remember, in addition to the fact that like he was successful, even though he, again, not my cup of tea, is that like, this guy was hired to do a job, did the job exceptionally well, was like, they maneuvered to fire him and get him out of that job like three different times. And he just like plodded along and like did his thing and like made the people who watched him like very happy and like was otherwise like entirely forgettable. This is not a person worth expending the energy to be like anyone who sticks up for him is a Nazi. It's just like, hey, if that's your feeling about someone who says Jay Leno is not the most horrible person in the world, you might want to step back from the keyboard a little bit.
Yeah,
It's
again, that
Jay Leno. It's not worth it either way. Like, Jay Leno is not worth passionately loving or passionately hating. He's just kind of there, like a, you know, like a mediocre painting in a hotel room. You know, like it's fine. Like I admire his work ethic. I think he's incredibly intelligent. I think there are lessons to be learned from some of the ways he's lived his life that are good. I wish he had taken his considerable talent and done more with it. But like, I'm also just like the people that are like, he's the devil for what he did to David Letterman. He's the devil for what he did to Conan O'Brien. It's just like, I think everyone's doing fine. It's okay. It's all okay.
Everybody's millionaires. We're all right here. It's okay. But I
Yeah.
realize that story has more to do about the internet than it does Jay Leno. But I just wrote this innocuous thing just saying he's probably leading a kind of Charles Foster Kane existence, and that's a little
Wow,
sad.
I
And
can't
I
think of anything
understand
more
that.
inoffensive
You
to
know,
write
and
than
yet,
what you
oh my
wrote about
God.
Jay freaking Leno.
I'm like, whoa. So okay. In terms of the movie, we'll talk just for a moment about Rich Little as Johnny Carson.
Oh,
What
man.
is your view of casting Rich Little, who doesn't look remotely like Johnny Carson? By doing this, it's kind of stunt casting because it's like he's not really playing Johnny Carson as a real person. He's playing the
No.
image of Johnny Carson, the
No, and like
icon of Johnny Carson.
the thing I was saying about casting the actors for Leno and Letterman, you know, in terms of how it's sometimes veered toward caricature. Look, I respect Rich Little for what he was and what he is.
He's still
It's
around, by the
fine.
way. He's old, but he's still around.
Yeah, but like I think that performance is, you know, it was limited, so, you know, in duration, the scope, so it wasn't that big a deal, but it was like very hackneyed and just very like you might as well have gotten Dana Carvey doing the Carson character in the like, do you know what I mean? It was just like, I guess we're just firing on all cylinders with the ticks, you know? And you know, whatever. That to me is like, oh, this is a cable TV movie from the 1990s.
That is the one element that I'm like, okay, they really didn't make an effort to make Johnny Carson seem like a real person. That seemed like an odd choice. And I will say, I've read about this from other people that have written about television and other outside of the Bill Carter book. Someone said that, like, you know, yes, it was kind of badass that Johnny reveals he's retiring on stage and he doesn't tell any of the NBC executives, and they're literally caught, not literally, but like they're metaphorically caught with their pants down. And I saw someone point out, they said, you know, yeah, that's kind of cool because it seems such a baller move. But they were like, that actually did kind of screw Letterman a little bit because by not giving NBC the heads up, they had to rush and make a rushed decision. They said it might have been if Carson had sat them down and said, "Look, guys, I'm going to leave in 2 years. I would prefer Letterman to take over for me," who he clearly did. We learn in the other Bill Carter book, The War for Late Night, that in retirement, Carson actually sent jokes to Letterman to read, like really wrote jokes for Letterman.
And they
He
socialized, and Johnny Carson
and
just
they.
didn't socialize with a lot of
He
people, and
did
neither did
not
Dave
like Jay
Letterman.
Leno and did not like Helen
Well,
Kushnick in any way.
I think he, what I would say is, I don't, he did not like Helen Kushnick. I mean,
He didn't like Helen Kushnick.
my view on this has always been Carson revered and respected Letterman, and Letterman obviously revered Carson. Letterman was obviously Carson's number one choice to host the show. I think he thought Jay Leno was perfectly good and perfectly fine. And Carson's, you know, attitude on Leno was, if you're not going to have David Letterman, the obvious pick, host the Tonight Show after me, Jay Leno is probably one of like three or four people that would make sense. But I don't know why you wouldn't pick David Letterman. I think again, Jay Leno was like the permanent guest host of the Tonight Show for 5 years. Like they got along fine. They had a very business-like relationship. If you ever see Leno on Carson's show, they got along very well. Johnny Carson thought he was extremely funny. They had good banter, but it was not the kind of organic electricity that he had with Letterman. And I would say that ironically, you're right that like Carson kind of ended up screwing them with his preemptive announcement. But ironically, the preemptive announcement, and this was more teased out in the book than it was in the movie, like the only reason he made that announcement was that his hand was forced because Helen Kushnick planted a story in the New York Post that NBC was looking to dump Carson for Leno.
Yep.
And Carson was like, oh, okay, we'll see about that. So it's like, again, like, you know, he was in response to like a dastardly thing that the Leno camp did, but he ended up handing them the weapon to like make a move.
Yep. There's a story. It's not in the movie. I know we're kind of now just really talking about the whole late night thing, not so much the movie, but I can't help it. There's a story in the book that is like, it just underscores how much of like, no matter how much you do for these people, these network people, it's never enough. And the story that I heard was that, again, for people who don't know, Johnny Carson had three children, one of whom died in an accident, in a car, yeah. in a car accident where he fell off a cliff while he was shooting pictures. He was a photographer. And he died during, like, Johnny's last year, Rick Carson. And, of course, that's, you know, the worst thing anybody can really experience in life is probably that, right?
Yeah.
And so there's an episode of The Tonight Show where, and this is like the 30th year, right? So this is Johnny Carson having made untold billions of dollars for the NBC network, right? Having just, and dominated the time period for 30 years. I mean, he just fended off every attacker for 25 years. Dick Cavett and Merv Griffin and Mike, like all these people who tried to take him on, and they felled them all, and Johnny just kept rolling. But there was apparently an episode of the show at the end of the show where Carson tells the audience what has happened. I mean, it was in the news. Everybody had heard about it. And he does a little tribute to his late son.
And showing photographs that he was taking, right?
Showing photographs that his son took. And apparently at some point during on air, like not live, the show wasn't live, but while they literally were recording the show, Carson looked off camera for a moment to his producer, Freddie DeCordova, the guy who they were always making jokes about. And DeCordova, in a moment that you're like, how the fuck would you do this?
Yeah.
Gave Carson the signal, wrap it up.
Yeah.
And you're like,
yeah,
holy shit.
Yeah.
This guy is your number one signature star and has made you I don't even have the words for it. And yet you can't even give the guy 2 minutes to talk about something serious. And apparently the minute DeCordova knew it, he knew he screwed up. Like he just did it and then was like, oh my God, what did I just do? And apparently
Carson talked to him for like the rest of his life.
Yeah. Like it soured their relationship. But I'm like, imagine being so successful and all you're like, I just need 2 minutes of the show to talk about something, my dead son. And they're like, well, can you cut it to 90? That'd be great if you could do 90. Yeah. Got to sell more Rice-A-Roni. Like,
shit. And that's why, I mean, a story like that just kind of like drives home this idea of just like, when you think of these machinations by like the Letterman and his camp and Jay Leno and his camp, and it's just like, hey, I think it's probably healthy to start with the assumption that like these network people feel like they owe you nothing and it's purely transactional. Yeah. And when you think of, you know, you think of like Letterman, you know, wanting to stay at NBC, or Conan O'Brien wanting to badly to stay at NBC, and they both said that like, it's just being attached to my body of work. I really just one network, one signature thing, one signature experience for, you know, decades. It's my body of work is so important to me. And it's just like, hey, you know what? They don't care. Yep. They will strip down and like disassemble and sell for parts everything. There is no loyalty. If they can do that to Johnny Carson after 30 years of being your signature star, wanting a couple extra minutes to talk about his recently deceased son, and you're giving the wrap it up, like these people have no conscience. So I think, you know, writ large, it's probably was long past time for these network stars to think about like, to stop thinking about, you know, in terms of like, oh, the loyalty. Of course, the network will value me for my loyalty. David Letterman sitting there thinking, well, I've been here 10 years. I've generated millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe in profits for the network. Like, of course they'll recognize it. No, it
No.
is. It's not even what have you done for me lately. It's like, what will you do for me tomorrow?
Yes.
And like the and again, this trickles down, right? This is where you and I, the normies are just like, hey, your companies are not your family. It's like you should stop saying that because that's BS. But like, yeah, I mean, I think that was a really instructive early lesson, and it should have been a good signal to people like LaSalle, who worked at the Carson show back then, to be like, you know what, these people have, he was the one urging you, Letterman, to go to Ovitz, and like, you should not be consigned to second class status just because NBC passed you over. You can go to another network. It's fine. There's this great, sorry, and then this is the last time I'll go afield, but there's this great, the second Bill Carter late night book wraps up with an anecdote by Jerry Seinfeld after the whole Conan debacle, where Jerry Seinfeld is talking about how, like, oh man, these guys are talking about like, I will not go on at midnight, as Conan said. I will not destroy the integrity of the Tonight Show. And Seinfeld, and I have my problems with Seinfeld, especially lately. But like, Seinfeld made the very, sharp and prescient point, accurate point that, like, what are you talking about? There is no institution to protect. It's a time slot. It's a time slot on a show. You can do whatever you want at any time. You won't go. This is why I came down on Leno's side during the Conan thing too. It was like, I'm sorry, they wanted to move your show half an hour later. I think everyone's going to be fine. I think it's going to be okay. Like, what are you talking about? I will not destroy the institution of the Tonight Show. What are you talking about? And then again, that story, like about DeCordova and like giving the wrap up signal. I'm like, this is just fake. These are time slots on imaginary networks. It doesn't matter. There's just because there's a peacock in the corner of your television doesn't mean anything. Just relax. Everybody relax.
And what one of the going back to the movie is that one of the ways this thing I think it becomes so compelling is that in the second half, it does become like a very gentle version, but like a thriller, because what happens is over the whole deal is that no matter what this, and we talked about it like an hour ago, but this contract that Letterman signed was so draconian that it did not leave him a lot of wiggle room. But Ovitz is incredibly smart businessman, and he figures out, well, no, we're not going to visit these networks and pitch Letterman. We can't do that because the contract forbids it, but we can't stop them from coming to talk to us, right? And so therefore you get this montage of all the different networks coming in and pitching, and like Brandon Tartikoff, who's moved to Paramount, is like, you can follow Arsenio. And it's like, what the hell are you talking about? I gotta
Rupert
follow
Murdoch
Arsenio.
coming.
Rupert Murdoch, oh my God. And
Baby Bob Iger.
Baby Bob Iger, played by Nicholas Guest, Christopher Guest's brother, who is incredibly handsome, by the way. But they point out that the way that Ovitz figures this out is he says, okay, CBS wants you because here's their chance to finally get into late night. They're going to offer you their whatever contract we come up with, NBC has the right to match it. And if they match it, you're screwed and you're stuck and you can't leave 12:30 ever. But what we've come up with is that CBS is going to say, we will give you an 11:30 show following the news. And if we don't, you get like
It was $50
$100 million,
million. It
$50
was a
million
penalty clause
dollars.
because CBS was going to wanted to give him 11:30 in the first place.
Right.
It
And so
was,
that.
and it was so ingenious. It was so ingenious because it targeted the time slot aspect of it, which no one understood at NBC. That was all that David Letterman wanted. And again, like, and again, not to bring in more recent trivia, but just like the thing that like screwed
That's
Conan
what screwed
was
Conan.
he did not have that time slot protection, and everyone assumed that he had it because it was basic at that point. But like, and you know what I will say about the, I mean, Ovitz, as portrayed by Treat Williams in this movie and in the real life, the thing about the Ovitz of it all is that he delivered everything he promised
He
Letterman
did.
in
He
that initial,
really did.
because you know
He
what
really
else, Rob?
did.
The most underreported aspect of that movie, which is something that I think was a flaw in the movie because I think it was one of the bigger aspects of the book and not enough is made of this story, is that NBC, at the end of the day, NBC came to Ovitz and Letterman to offer David Letterman the Tonight Show.
Yes, they did.
And like that, not enough is made of that fact. Now they were, it ended up not getting to the point where they could accept or reject it because they kind of preemptively strangled it in the crib, because It was not under the terms that Letterman would have wanted. It would have had him wait an extra year and a half into 1994. It did not give him ownership of the show. It was, all sorts of like little caveats, but like they offered him the Tonight Show, and it was less salary and like all these little poison pills. But like if Letterman had really wanted to, he could have waited it out, and he could have had the show. And like it's such a miracle, because not only did Ovitz get Dave, like, the entertainment industry on a platter, like bidding for his services, he got him the Tonight Show offer. Like it is from idea to execution, as portrayed by Treat Williams, it was like this perfect divine intervention in Letterman's life. And I think it's just portrayed so well in the movie.
It really is, right? Because it's like the way you're like, okay, well, if CBS doesn't give you 11:30, you're going to get 50 million. Well, that means NBC has to match that, which they
Yeah.
can't do because they've got Leno at 11:30. And that's really the thing that breaks it apart. And then you have this marvelous scene. And again, this is the part of the reason I love this movie so much is that, as we've talked about many times, this is such low stakes, right?
Yeah.
We see Letterman's beach home. You
Yeah.
know, and you're like, oh, poor baby. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the worst.
I should tell you, I do not have a beach home, Rob.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, the worst thing you have in your life is that you don't have a job anymore and you just sit on your out on the deck on the ocean. Oh
Yeah.
my God,
All these
how
movies, it's
will
so
you
funny. All these
survive?
movies, treat like the prospect of someone being paid by a network or a high-paying job to like go away and like sit around and do nothing. They treat it as akin to a death. And I'm just like,
Oh,
what are you talking about?
it's
You're
all I
getting
want out
paid
of
$10
life.
million to go away? That sounds
Oh,
amazing. What's wrong with you?
I would do it. I'll go away for way less than that.
Yeah,
Trust me, everybody.
exactly.
If some corporation wants to pay me off, that's no problem. But
Yeah.
there's this amazing scene with, again, Stephen Gilborn, whose face looks like an old shoe. And I mean that in the nicest way possible, and that he is all wrinkly, but he has this kind, he's a brutal business consigliere, and yet he is so gentle and he's so warm, and all he wants is what's best for Letterman. And he is, and so there's this marvelous scene where they talk about offering Letterman the Tonight Show, as you just mentioned, where they're like, you're going to get it after 18 months and you're going to take over. And Letterman is ready to do it. Letterman is ready
Yeah.
to say, no, I'll do it. And then it's LaSalle who says, you have to realize something. First of all, if you do this, the press will go after you. Because
Yeah.
you'll be the one that pushed your friend out of a job. Do you, is that that what you want? And then he goes, and then he find, and then Letterman's like, I can't turn down that show. And LaSalle goes, what show? Johnny's
Yeah.
show? And Letterman's like, yes. And he goes, don't you realize that show is gone? You're not taking over the Johnny Carson Tonight Show. You're taking over the Jay Leno show,
Yeah.
and they're going to make you wait 18 months to do it. And there's just like,
Yeah.
you just wish. Everyone would want that kind of person in their life, right? An older person who just is looking out for you and is sharp, but will give you the real story when you need to hear
Yeah.
it. And it's,
Talk about a consigliere.
oh my God, I love it. So now this is the trivia that I found that I could
Oh,
not wait to tell
great.
you about.
Okay.
So it occurred to me while we were researching this that I was like, I've never actually heard Peter LaSalle's voice. I've seen pictures of him.
Yeah.
I've never actually heard him talk, right? I don't think I've
Okay.
heard an interview with him. So I was like, let me see if I can find him. Because
Yeah.
he retired and then he unretired because he found Craig Kilborn and
Yeah.
he was one of the executive producers of the
Yeah.
Late Late Show with Craig
Yeah.
Kilborn for many years.
He's
And
super old. I think he's super old.
he's like in his mid-90s now,
Yeah,
because
yeah.
like I said, he was born in, I think, like 1932. But
Yeah.
nevertheless, he was older and he was shepherding Craig Ferguson
Yeah.
through his years as a late show talk show host. But it mentions, oh, he made some appearances on the show, on the Craig Kilborn, on the, that's not Craig Kilborn, Craig Ferguson show. And I'm
Yeah.
like, oh, that's interesting. Let me see if I can find that clip just so I can hear his voice, right? I find this clip where it opens with executive producer Peter LaSalle talking to Craig Ferguson, and there's this joke about cutting a pirate sketch, and it's all very silly. But it is not Peter LaSalle. It is the actor from this movie
Oh, you're
playing
kidding.
Peter LaSalle. It
That's
is
really funny.
Stephen Gilborn playing Peter LaSalle a full decade after this movie aired, and I thought, who the fuck is getting that joke?
That's brilliant.
Except for the 8 people that worship this movie like I do. I could not. I wrote it down on a post-it note because I'm like, I cannot forget to tell Omar this. I couldn't believe it.
I did not know that. That's a great detail. That's hilarious.
I'm like, it was like the equivalent of like being 8 years old and like hearing about like Boba Fett for the first time. Like just some little, I'm like, there's an extended late shift universe now that exists that I'm like, I love that they made the effort to find Stephen Gilborn and have it because the audience is not going to know. They don't know what Peter LaSalle looks like. They think that's
that is so beautifully inside baseball.
I was so happy when I discovered that.
Yeah, that's hilarious. I was like, check that out.
I was like, I love all of you. Yeah. I just love all of you that you did this. This is
that is
so
committing
fantastic.
To the bit.
So it is so committing. So this, I watch this movie. It just makes me feel good. It just, even though it's people going through the Letterman, go these machinations.
It's that song, There's No Business Like Show Business. It is just brings to bear, which is the credit sequence song. It's like, it's an old standard, but it also like, it makes you feel bathed in like the ecosystem of this movie. And just it washes over you because it's just like, this is so silly and so beautiful. Right? It's like you, especially looking through the landscape of like 2026, where like everything seems so like fraught. And it's just like, these are the battles that they're talking about. This is like where people are going to war over time slots and an hour here and half an hour there and penalty clauses and contracts and Jay Leno's hiding in the bathroom and feeling, you know, giddy about it and eavesdropping on like Pinhead Network executives. And like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just like, oh, though, you know what it is, Rob? Those were the days for a certain refined type of man, as you and I have pretensions of being like that, those were the days. Yep. There's an abject silliness and knowing that, yes, I mean, specifics aside, yes, like Helen Kushnick's ending is tragic. But like beyond that, like everyone's fine. Like everyone was fine. Everyone is going to end up being fine. And if you watch like interviews with David Letterman afterward for the decades afterward, and you understand the grounded perspective he has on like the whole business, and you see Jay Leno and it's like, yep, he's the same guy he always was. A kind of inscrutable, kind of a mystery, maybe not my cup of tea, my sensibility, maybe not as evolved as I like to be, but he's also fine. Like, it's all okay. And I think there's this, the movie evokes nostalgia. And I think the way it's shot and it's a very quick hit, scenes are very fast. Scenes are very fraught. There's actually not a ton of exposition. I often wonder how the movie would play to not only people who had not read the book, but people who didn't know anything about the story. And I'd just be like, oh, yeah, no, this is not for you. But it's just very, like, guerrilla kind of filmmaking. It's just very fast. It's very fast. There's very little exposition. It's just very, you know, on the go. And, like, the decisions, like, have a high import and have high stakes. And, like, nonetheless, you feel like you're building up to something. Right up to the very end where, like, Letterman and Morty and LaSalle take that walk across the street to Radio City Music Hall to do the CBS press conference. Mm-hmm. And it feels like imbued with significance. You know what I mean? It's nostalgia, but it's a specific kind of nostalgia for nerds like you and me.
This movie is 95 minutes long. And if I heard, oh, you know what? We found the 2.5 hour cut of the late shift. Yeah. I would be like, give it to me. Give it to me. I would not hesitate for one moment. I'd be like, I will purchase that however you need me to purchase it. You know, it's just that.
Listen,
it's that compelling.
They every once in a while in a blue moon on some weird stray Reddit thread, they talk about doing a sequel based on the War for Late Night.
Well, that's,
and they talk about about starring Tilda Swinton as
Tilda
Conan.
Swinton as Conan. Yeah.
You know, so let's do it. Let's start a letter writing campaign.
Well, that's okay. We've been talking for 2 hours, and so we do need to wrap this up. But we can't end this without talking about that a little bit, because if there's anything even more compelling than Bill Carter's original book, it's the sequel book, The War for Late Night, which details the whole Mishegoss.
By the way, these are both brilliant books, and like you got listeners. whatever seven of you are weird and like have this insane interest in this story, you
that
should
are
read those
listening to
books.
hour three of this
They're
podcast.
delightful. They're delightful books. They are so chock full of incredible reporting that not only like traffic and like the kind of gossip that we love, but also are like really good psychological profiles of like Letterman and Leno and Conan O'Brien and Craig Ferguson and Jon Stewart. It's like they're Bill Carter is a first-rate reporter.
Some of the stuff he gets is like he gets conversations that like Conan had in bed with his wife. And I'm like,
Yeah, it's
how the
insane.
who told? I mean, obviously one of the two of them told him that, but I'm like,
But no one's denying it, Rob.
how the
No
hell did he
one's
get
saying
that
this is
stuff?
trash.
You know, it's
Yeah.
unbelievable. So they absolutely need to do a sequel. They just
Yes,
do with
they
Daniel
do.
Roebuck again as
Yeah.
Jay, like they need to get everybody back
Yeah.
and I, you know, like why not have Tilda Swinton play Conan? Like just make it goofy. Like just take that flight
Absolutely.
of fancy because any reserve of goodwill that Jay Leno might have had with the average
Oh,
person,
God.
he just threw into the shitter by the
Yes, he
thing
did.
with Conan, which was an even bigger mess than the one
Well,
with
and the
Letterman.
thing with Letterman was that, you know, the reputation that Leno came out of it with was, I mean, feel free to correct me if I'm wrong, but it was just like, it was entertainment people and people on the inside, nerds like you and me, were like, maybe we're left with the impression that Jay Leno was not like the most honorable person in the world after the Letterman fiasco. But like, I feel like normies were just like, eh, I don't know what you're talking about. It's whatever. But like when the Conan thing happened, I think because it was even more high profile and because it took place over a more compressed period of time, and because the internet and social media was a thing in a way that it wasn't in the early 90s, I think Jay Leno was much more perfectly positioned to blow up as the villain, the big heavy, with the broader public in the way that he did in 15 years before that.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that like they would give the show. He said he would retire, and
Yeah.
then they gave the show to Conan, and then he was
Yeah.
like, "Oh, wait, I don't really want to retire. I'm going to go to another
Well,
network." And
sorry,
all this.
dude. You know I'm team com t actually team J on that one too. Even though again, I absolutely prefer Conan O'Brien's comedy. But like you are correctly and accurately retelling the portrayal of how it went down. And we might not have time to get into granular details. But like honestly on that one, even on the merits, I'm actually team J.
How so? I'm not saying I
Yeah, yeah,
disagree
yeah.
with you, but how so?
So here's what it is. Like, I think a convenient detail that people forget is that this whole thing started because, like, Conan in the early and mid 2000s, after a few rocky years, was finally the hot thing. And like NBC was worried about like a succession plan, but mainly because like Jay was in his early to mid 50s, as you and I were talking about, has like a very robust work ethic with no other noted interest in his life, and would have been quite happy easily doing it for another like 15 years minimum by the time it got to 2002, 2003, 2004. And Conan was like, gotta move up, gotta move up. Conan was born in 1963. He grew up in the generation that revered Johnny Carson and thought of the Tonight Show as an institution. And so he was like, I gotta move up. I need the Tonight Show. And NBC kept trying to renew him for late night. And in 2000, like, you know, he came close in 2001 to leaving for Fox, who was willing to put him on earlier. NBC got him to stay for like 3 years longer. And then in 2004, when his contract was up again, Conan and his people were like, the only condition under which we're staying is if you give me the Tonight Show. And NBC was like, okay, well, we just signed Jay Leno. What if we told you that Jay would leave in 5 years and we could sign you for 5 years? And then after that, we guarantee you the Tonight Show. Would you stay then? Conan said, fine, that's the condition under which I would stay. They go to Jay. They're like, hey, we want Conan to take over the Tonight Show. And he's just like, well, I've been number one for 15 years. What are you talking about? They're like, hey, this is the condition for doing it, or Conan walks. So we're giving you 5 years. This is your last contract for hosting the Tonight Show. We will let you save face by announcing that it is your decision. And so, like, maybe his only mistake in all of this was going on TV and saying, you know what? NBC came to me, said, we don't want to lose Conan. And he was like, I don't want to lose Conan either. And so I've been doing this for, I will have done this for 17 years. In 5 years, I'll leave. He left. You know, he they gave him a pro. The NBC started to panic. because they saw kind of the ratings, like the shakiness that Conan was having relative to Craig Ferguson.
All of
They
a sudden,
started.
Conan started cooling off in that 5 years.
Yep. So they went to Jay. They're like, "Hey, we can give you. You want a weekend show? You want prime time? We'll do anything." And Jay was just like, "Well, I mean, if you're really offering me prime time, if it's a way for my people to stay, sure, we'll take it." Which apparently was a cardinal sin. They gave him like a 10 o'clock prime time show.
Which was a
And
terrible show.
it was, of course, it was a terrible show. Conan took over the Tonight Show. Conan had it for 7 months. For the first time in 15 years, the Tonight Show started losing to the Late Show with David Letterman in the ratings. NBC said, "Hey, this is untenable. What do you think about the Tonight Show moving half an hour later? Jay getting a half an hour to tell his jokes leading into you, and Conan and his people being like, 'This will not stand. This is a violation of the sacred, whatever.'" And like Jay was like, "Yeah, I mean, if you want me to come back at 11:30, I'd be happy to." Like, I just don't, like, you know what I mean? I'm just like, I don't really understand that there's a villain in this situation. And just remember, this all started because Conan was like, "Get this guy the fuck out of here, or I'm walking." Conan could have left. Like, everyone is just like, "Why didn't Jay leave? Jay said he was leaving. Why didn't he just leave?" And it's just like, well, why didn't Conan leave? Who says, "I will take this promotion in 5 years"? I'm not saying that like Jay is better than Conan. I'm just think it's the line's a little blurry where I actually don't actually think it's that much of a villain. Conan's ratings were not good. He lost to Letterman. Like, you can blame his lead-in, I suppose, but like Jay didn't lead in until September. Conan had it since June. And from June to September, Letterman was beating him. And it was just not generating the kind of profits and ratings. Like, you and I know that Conan had a better show than Jay, but like, I don't know, money talks. And so, like, can you seriously argue with a straight face that if Conan had continued to be the host of The Tonight Show, that like Conan would have been better off? I feel like he would have been straitjacketed. Conan's career since like getting the boot from NBC has been this whirlwind, this creative explosion, these travel shows, this like amazing podcast, like getting to host the Academy Awards. Like, again, he is sui generis. I just feel like, give Jay Leno the Tonight Show. Who cares? At a time when like people are like abandoning network talk shows in droves and networks and linear television in droves, you want Jay Leno to host the Tonight Show? Fine. Like, there was no great injustice done. Everything worked out the way it was supposed to. Am I off base?
No, I don't think so. This was one of those things where, even more than in the first go round, everybody did something wrong. In this
Sure.
scenario, everybody.
Sure.
It's like, look, Jay, like, I don't think Jay should have, like, there's an interview where he's like, well, if they offered me 11:30, I'd take it again. And it's like, that probably the nicest thing in the world. He should have just taken the deal from ABC that, they wanted him and go
Yeah.
with that and
Yeah.
compete head to head against Conan and,
Yeah.
whatever. So there on that, that's a little like, come on, Jay. You said you would retire, or you said you'd leave the network. Leave the goddamn network. So that's
Yeah.
one end. And then the other end, it's like, look, Conan O'Brien is not the host of The Tonight Show. He just isn't. He's not the right fit. He just isn't.
No, he just isn't. He's
He
his
won't.
own brand. Like, would you rather be the host of The Tonight Show, or would you rather like have the brand that Conan O'Brien has had for the last 35 years, where like his one name, it's like he is powerful as like Oprah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and like, talk about a body of work that is a unique, asymmetrical body of work. That is a legacy. And he would have been straitjacketed if he had remained on The Tonight Show for the past 17 years.
The average Tonight Show viewer does not want to watch
Yeah.
Paul Rudd come on Conan and show that Mac and Me clip for the 95th time. I
Or
find
like
it
Norm Macdonald
hysterical.
telling weird, arcane
Or Norm
jokes.
Macdonald telling, right. And they even talk about that in the book where they're like, one of the NBC execs is like, turns Conan on for like his ninth episode, and it's like Norm Macdonald is on, and he's like, what the hell? How is Norm Macdonald the lead guest on the Tonight
Yeah.
Show? He's like,
He's not
this,
wrong.
right? But right, so there's that. But then I'm like, yeah, but NBC is also wrong by giving him the job.
Yes.
They get like, and once you give.
And you have to ask Conan. Yes, that is right. And you have to ask Conan. It's just like, even in 2001, 2003, 2004, when everything is changing, why are you holding on to this dream of the Tonight Show? It goes back to what Peter LaSalle was telling Letterman. You're not taking over Johnny Carson's show. That is not the show you were watching in Brookline, Massachusetts, like sitting on your dad's lap. Like, that show is gone.
Yep.
When Johnny Carson retired, that's the other thing. The same way that I told you like a couple hours ago that like what people essentially fail to realize was that it's this one show that
Yeah, the
everyone
Seinfeld
wants.
quote.
And
There is no Tonight Show. It's
there is no
Johnny.
Tonight
It's
Show.
Dave.
The
It's this.
minute Johnny Carson left, even when Jay hosted it for 22 years, no one was like, "Oh, the Tonight Show." They were like, "Oh, that guy was on Leno. Did you see Will Ferrell on Leno?"
Yep.
Like the institution left. There is no institution to protect. Why was Conan so like fixated with like the Tonight Show? Because of his age demographics, he viewed it as a legacy thing, and he was smart to realize very quickly after the implosion of his Tonight Show that like, no, there's another way of doing this. So I
Yep.
actually think everything worked out the way it was supposed to, and like, again, Jay Leno is too small potatoes to be like, this man is responsible for everything that's wrong with Western civilization. It's like, no, honestly, given Jay Leno's sensibilities and given what network television was and will be, it became, Jay Leno was actually, in turn, retrospect, the perfect host for The Tonight Show. Why is everyone fighting this? Let him host The Tonight Show. Who cares?
Yeah, it's a different. Right. There is like Johnny Carson presided over an era of Hollywood and show business that is
Yes.
gone.
The
It's it
monoculture.
the monoculture, and to where people there was this remove of way people interacted with show business. So Johnny Carson had the stature to interview John Wayne and, like I
Yep.
mentioned, Jimmy Stewart and Bette Davis. And to preside over these younger comedians, we didn't even talk about that, that like Johnny Carson gave birth
Yeah.
to an entire generation of comedians,
Your
including
Paul
my
Reiser's, your
favorite, Albert
Seinfelds, your Hugh
Brooks.
Carey's, your Roseanne's. Like,
Yeah,
yeah.
right. You know, everybody. And that's not what Jay Leno did. That's not what Letterman did, because they were contemporaries. It was more
No.
like, hey, I'm having this guy on or whatever. It's not the same thing as Johnny giving the benediction to somebody, because they said back in the old days, literally, your life would change if you did
Yeah.
well on The Tonight Show for the
It's
first
just
time.
not the institution
No.
that all these people thought it was. And like Letterman eventually figured it out.
Yep.
Conan eventually figured it out. Like, it's just not worth it. So when people are just like thrashing around assigning blame to like Jay Leno for like ruining this institution and like ruining careers and being a monster, and it's just like, no, the Tonight Show became this incredibly small thing. And that would, and in retrospect, it's actually perfect that Jay Leno, of all people, like hosted it. And if I was a network executive, I would have like, in retrospect, I would have put Jay in there, and I would have like, when people wanted to get him out of there in like 2004, I would have been like, oh yeah, no, just pay Conan off. Pay Conan off for not being the Tonight. And like, even in 2014, when they wanted to give it to Jimmy Fallon, I would have been like, I don't care. This is literally like Sophie's choice of choices I don't care about. But if Jay wants to keep doing it, fine. I don't care. Like, you know what I mean? It's just, again, low stakes. So like, I'm defensive about Jay Leno because it's just like, no, I think everyone is just kind of rendering their garments over something like fundamentally silly. And again, Conan could have realized where things were going and that the Tonight Show was not this prize worth having. And also, he and his people, led by Ari Emanuel, his hard-charging agent, you know, Rahm's brother, like they were gunning for Leno and they were like, the only way we'll stay is if we get the Tonight Show. Well, okay, you are basically wanting to displace another person. And the reason people conveniently forget that is because they like Conan and they don't like Jay Leno. And it's like, okay, but that's it's you like one and you don't like the other, and let's just be honest about that. It's not about
Yeah.
integrity because Conan wanted to get rid of Jay Leno too. Do you know what I mean? That's
Yeah.
what that I
Yeah.
just want consistency.
Yeah, completely. Completely. It's it. Yeah, there is there will, for people again who were too young to remember, there will be nothing like Johnny Carson ever again. But at the same time,
Right.
it's very interesting that these shows that exist, and now of course there's three of them, right? There used to be one and now there's three, all on competing networks.
Yeah.
And but yet people still, even though they don't watch them to anywhere near the level they used to, even under Jay Leno, certainly
Yeah.
not under Carson, but people still want them there because, and I don't want to get into a whole thing, but like, look what happened to Jimmy Kimmel
Yeah.
when it was like, oh my God, Jimmy Kimmel got taken off because of political reasons.
Yeah.
People lost their minds with good reason, by the way,
Yeah.
with good
No, they
reason. I am
did.
not, you know, but it that says something about most
The
people don't.
institution and the cultural cachet that they have, I
Yes,
think it
you.
does. And I think that, like, you know, look, it's still, I think the inevitability of it all is still happening. Like, you know, they're cutting Jimmy Fallon's Tonight Show to 4 days a week. You see what's happening with, like, CBS and Colbert, which is, I think, is extra sad because, like, that whole institution that David Letterman created in 1993 as, like, the first genuine bona fide long-term sustainable, like, challenge to the Tonight Show's rating, like, supremacy, ad dollar supremacy, rating supremacy, cultural supremacy. It's just kind of going away. So I think it's kind of death by a thousand cuts. But it is true that on some semblance of the culture, maybe more from people 5 to 10 years older than you and above, there is still an outcry and a pushback against getting rid of it altogether. But it's definitely not the same landscape that it was 30 years ago, and it won't be.
Most people don't watch Jimmy Kimmel, but the thought of it being taken away is like, whoa, don't do that. No, don't do that. And that says something about the format that's been created. These are shows that people want to know they're there, even if they don't watch them. And that's what I was with Carson. It was like I watched it intermittently, but I always knew it was there, and I knew I could turn it in it turn out turn it on at any time. And maybe it was a guest host, maybe not, but there it was. He was like, oh, there's
And its
Johnny, and he's being
placement
silly.
in
Great, awesome.
the placement in the cultural pantheon is another reason why people like you and I get so giddy. I mean, here's the thing about you and why are we so interested in this, despite the fact that it ain't Citizen Kane, this movie,
No.
is that, like, you and I also are raised on this stuff. And there is a small subset of Americans that, like, kind of get off on sort of the entertainment industry, are steeped in its lore and steeped in the trivia and, like, the personalities. And we are, in many ways, longing for the fact that, like, that is going away. That is all going away, but it's part of the monoculture going away. And so to be able to bask in a movie that captures, like, the dizziness and the heights and how fraught and how, frankly, silly everything was is, listen, it's a balm. It's a balm in these
It is.
times. And it's a balm for people like you and me that have a very specific interest. It's like people who love baseball, bathing in, like well-made nostalgic baseball movies that really capture an era, even if in retrospect it's just like, is this the most well-made movie in the world? Not necessarily, but it sort of captures in an ineffable quality that you and I really have obsessed over as part of our, growing up period.
Absolutely. So, well, we've been now talking an hour longer than the movie ran.
I am so sorry.
No. I fully expected this. Is there anything? Look, we're never going to talk about this again because
No.
what, So, is there anything else that you have on your notes that you want to get to before we sign off? Is there any other? I don't want you to hang up and go, ah, oh, I wish we had mentioned X. So, is there anything else that you want to just, even though it's, we've sort of wrapped up, is there any other details you just want to mention before we sign off?
No, I would just honestly, I would just say a blanket recommendation because you've given quite consistently and deservedly the qualification to people that, like, hey, if you haven't seen the movie, if you're unfamiliar with the story, and it's just like, if you have a modicum of interest in entertainment, if you are like 1/10 or even 1/50 the geek that Rob and I are, and you must be on some level audience member because you tune into these podcasts.
You're listening
Okay.
to this
If
right
you
now,
are, yeah, if you're into the Fire and Water Network, there's some aspect of the biz that you're into, and there's some aspect that like this captures the nostalgia of. So I would just put in a plug for not only the movie, which is quite entertaining. These two books are phenomenal
Oh, the books are
artifacts,
so good. So good.
phenomenal and breezy, accessible. They're not dense. You can read them. I read them easily as, like, a sophomore in high school, as easily as I read them as a 21-year-old, as easily as I read them in my mid-40s. They're just breezy, like, entertainment that doesn't make you feel like guilty or cheap, because it has the imprimatur of a former New York Times reporter, And so, like, if you want to be, kind of be bathed in that era and be captured by it, read those books, watch that movie, check out some of the YouTube clips that Rob is talking about, the power of Johnny Carson and his charisma and how inventive Letterman was and how we both love Conan and how talented, singularly talented Jay Leno was, especially when he was in the early and mid-80s on appearing on Letterman show. You, like, just do yourself a favor. Like, check out some of those clips, read it. Like, you will get, even if you don't end up being a full-time obsessive like us, you will kind of on some level be like, I kind of get it. And that is my wish. I think everything else, we've like plumbed the depths of the story. But like, I really would urge listeners of the fire, you know, like this whole podcast and the whole network to just check some of this stuff out. Like, and a lot of it, if nothing else, is also super funny. Those clips are funny. The anecdotes from the reporting are funny. And like people like David Letterman and Jay Leno and the personalities around them are very unique figures in Americana of the late 20th century.
Absolutely. Yeah. As I mentioned, like this thing plays like the most relaxed, sunny, sun-kissed California thriller you're ever gonna
stressed
watch.
Out. You're never stressed out.
Yeah.
You're
everyone's in convertibles. You know, like there's no shadows except
everyone's
for Jay's hiding
be
in the closet
okay.
at one time.
You're interested in what's happening. You're excited about what's happening next, but you're never stressed out.
Yeah, it's just an absolute pleasure to watch. And I will say two last things I'll wrap up with is I mentioned if I ever see Daniel Roebuck at a con, I'm totally buying the DVD of this and getting him to sign it.
Sure.
If I ever meet John Michael Higgins at a con, not that he ever seems to do them, but if he ever did, or Kathy Bates, this is what I would get them to sign. This is what I've got. Unfortunately,
I would not blame you.
Stephen Gilborn has passed away, so he's not. But I would have killed to meet him because I'm sure he'd be like, "Oh my God, you're getting me to sign this." But that's what I like to do with these shows: is hand them stuff that they don't expect. And that is, if I ever meet Daniel Roebuck, that's what I'll do. So, speaking of the DVD, I like to use a term my wife likes to use. I'm going to manifest this thing: is that this movie is not on Blu-ray. Now, you could argue, probably shot on, not shot on like super high res cameras or anything, so maybe it wouldn't even look too great on Blu-ray. But it is not on Blu-ray. And I'm going to just put it out there in the universe, because why the hell not? It's my podcast, and I've been talking for 2.5 hours about this. If this was ever put on Blu-ray, I guess Warner Brothers is about to be owned by Netflix. They're not big on putting things on Blu-ray. But if this movie ever comes to Blu-ray, I need to do the audio commentary for it.
Oh, damn right, man.
I have done a bunch of audio commentaries in the last couple of years. I would kill to do the audio commentary for this movie. So I'm just putting it out in the universe. If for some reason HBO was like, you know what, we can make some money off of this, maybe we should add some features. I mean, obviously you'd get Bill Carter. He'd be the person because he's still around, still writing books. But if not, you want somebody cheap, call me. I
Rob's
would
your man.
Kill to do this.
I think you do a great job.
So thank you. So, okay. Thank you all for listening. Thank you again. If you're hearing this, you stuck with us. You stuck with us through this entire show. It's ridiculous.
Get help.
But Omar, this was like a dream come true to do this show. When I would watch this, and I always thought I was so alone in my appreciation of this movie. I would watch it and I was like, but what is wrong with me? Why am I watching this for the 95th time? And then I'm so glad that I absentmindedly just mentioned it on Blue Sky, because I was just like, maybe somebody out there. And then boom, you did. And I'm like, well, now we've got a podcast out of this.
The
glory
of the information superhighway, no matter how much, and social media, no matter how much it's been perverted, it is always nice to know that every once in a while, once in a blue moon, our weird little interests that we throw out into the world, there's always like one random person that we might know that's like, wait, you like that? You like this weird specific thing? Oh my God, I'm not alone. Oh my God. And it's that time, those times when I'm just like, all right, I see the appeal. I suppose the end of civilization as we know it is worth it. it's a real pleasure to talk about this. And I could really easily talk about this subject and this movie and these books for, even more hours on end. So it's just delightful that I get to talk about it with like kind of a fellow nerd who's like steeped in this era as well.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Rafa. I really appreciate it going. And thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of Fade Out, including a regular episode, which dropped earlier in the week, a regular episode on the career of Juliet Prowse. That's our regular episode. We have this bonus show. But all the episodes can be found on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to Fade Out in any podcatcher of your choice. You can find the show on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. And if you want to support Findwater Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FW Podcast, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D, Donald McWaters, and Mark Balbus for their support of Fade Out. I really do appreciate it. So again, thank you so much for listening. If you stuck with this show, please leave a comment and let us know. I'm dying to find out who out there is nuts that would listen to a 2.5-hour podcast about a 30-year-old TV movie about the late night wars. I want to find my, we want to, Omar and I want to find our fellow lunatics, late night, late shift lunatics out there.
Please.
Yeah. I want to have these, I don't want this conversation to end. I want to keep talking about this subject because it's so fascinating. So if you're listening to this, please leave a comment on the website and just let us know that you enjoyed it. And let us know if we left anything out. I don't think we did, but just in case there's some aspect of this whole story that we left out, or the movie or the situation, please let us know. So thank you all so much for listening to this bonus episode of Fade Out. We'll be back with a regular episode of the show, of course, next month as normal. But until then, I'm going to end the way we normally do. We've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Could have been a doctor.
Yeah, well, it's not too late, Rick.
Oh, Rick, we're running a little late, but I think we're going to be all right. The show should start, I think, around 11.
Well, that's great, Warren, but I wanted to...
Do me a favor. Would you hold that thought?
Well, I was about to call.
What, you know, what the hell?
Well, the ship has sailed. There's nobody here.
Jesus Christ, she sent the audience home. We don't have a Tonight Show. You know, I've already sold this thing to advertisers. Christ! She killed the scheduled show.
My level of tolerance with Helen Kushnick is completely used up.
So is ours.
That woman canceled a Tonight Show with no authorization whatsoever. We had less than half an hour to get that repeat on, or we would have gone dark. She is completely out of control.